Welcome to Mama Babies, a podcast for women with type 1 diabetes by women with type 1 diabetes. Join us every Thursday as we navigate through pregnancy, birth, and raising a child whilst living well with type 1 diabetes. The experiences shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice and should not be relied on as health or personal advice. Please seek the guidance of your treating team before making any changes to your diabetes or pregnancy care. On this week's episode of Mum and Babies, we are discussing assisted deliveries. Linda Moore, trusted midwife and diabetes educator, joins us again to talk about what an assisted delivery involves, why you might need one, how common they are, and the benefits and risks. Our lived experience guest, Isabel Smith, shares her induction experience and resulting womb juice, episiotomy, and forceps delivery. Today, your host is Ashley, and this is Mum and Babies. I just want to welcome back Belinda. Belinda, did you just want to give a quick hello to everybody before we jump into the main questions today?
Yeah, sure. Hey, Mama Beatty's crowd. Good to be back and talk about another layer to how you have a baby.
I'm very excited. And we do also have with us this week Isabel. So Isabel, would you like to just briefly introduce yourself, your background with your type 1 diabetes, and we'll jump into what assisted deliveries and your birth stories look like.
Absolutely. So hi, everyone. Very excited to be sharing my experience with you today. So as Hash mentioned it, I'm Isabel. I'm actually French-Canadian, born in Montreal, and I do speak French first. So I do apologize in advance if I do mispronounce here and there. I sound a bit funny. That's my accent. Yes, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in July 95, so at age 14. I'm a wife, I'm a mum of two beautiful children, Ruby, who's age 5, and Max, who's age 3. And I'm working nearly full time, so needless to say, I'm quite busy every day juggling family life, work life, and type 1 life.
Definitely busy.
Yeah, definitely. I've been diabetic type 1, or person living with diabetes, for over 26 years. And I've been pretty blessed with the fact that I'm complication-free with blood sugar control, you know, at best of times, I'd say. I've started managing with injections, but since 2011, I'm now on an insulin pump. And I went into this journey when I tried to conceive, in fact. And in terms of birth, obviously, I've had two complication-free pregnancies, apart from very severe morning sickness for both of them. I was induced for both pregnancies around 38 weeks. For both of them, both deliveries were vaginal birth, but they were also very different processes. And I think that's quite important to mention. So very briefly, Ruby was a 14-month labor, which ended up in assisted delivery, obviously, which is the topic of today. And Max, on the other end, was a very quick 3-hour labor on assisted delivery in the end. So there you go.
I'm so keen to hear more about how those births were different for you as we progress. And I'm so excited today about the topic of today, because when I was talking to Isabel about this topic earlier, my knowledge on assisted deliveries was very limited. And all I'd kind of heard about them from health professionals when I was preparing for delivery was not so nice things. And I think I found it a very scary topic. And I was very lucky to have Isabel call me and tell me that she wasn't, you know, frightened by her experience, or that she felt her experience was, it was what she needed at the time, and helped to kind of help me understand what an assisted delivery actually looks like for a woman with type 1 diabetes. So I'm very excited to be able to share that with you guys today. But I might start off today with Belinda, and I'm going to apologize. My voice is a little bit gone. I'm suffering from the flu at the moment. But Belle, I might just get you to start with a bit of an overview about what an assisted birth is and what types are available to women.
So I had to talk about the three different types of assisted births. And often when you say assisted birth, people only think of two different types, and that's the ventouse or the vacuum delivery or the suction cup. And the other one is a forceps delivery. The third type is actually an episiotomy. And often a lot of people won't, you can just have an episiotomy by itself without needing a ventouse or a vacuum, a forceps delivery. If you have an episiotomy assisted delivery, It may be that the baby's head has started to crown, but it's just not progressing past crowning, and the perineum might be a little bit too tight, or the baby's a little bit stuck. It might be shoulder dystocia. Episiotomy assisted delivery is very common for shoulder dystocia that can be easily managed without progressing to a cesarean section. So you can cut an episiotomy and you'll progress to a vaginal birth.
So it's kind of like widening the access.
It's just creating space, for the outlet for the baby's head to come through. I mean, there's pros and cons to everything we do. Episiotomies do take a long time to recover from. Some women will find it relatively easy, but it's still not pain-free for quite a number of weeks. There's a little bit of literature out there about routine episiotomies versus just spontaneous episiotomies, meaning that, for example, a woman might have had a history of a third degree tear from a vaginal birth, and they don't want that, or even the doctor might not want that third degree tear to happen again. So you could perhaps talk about a routine episiotomy to prevent that third degree tear happening in a subsequent delivery, and then preventing that third degree tear from becoming a fourth degree tear, which just no one wants ever. So that's that. In terms of...
That answered the question that I had in my head. I was like, why would you want an episiotomy over a tear? And you answered it straight away.
Yeah, look, that's a really good point. A lot of... it's more from a midwifery perspective we will try and opt, if we can, for tearing as opposed to episiotomies. And episiotomy is more an obstetric intervention. But generally, we will opt for tearing versus an episiotomy because of the way that a tear will heal versus the way that an episiotomy will heal. So tear will heal from inside coming up. And the episiotomy will do the other, which is why it often takes a lot longer to heal from an episiotomy. In regards to the other two types of deliveries, you've got your forceps and then you've got your ventouse. They're used for all different reasons. A ventouse, just to simplify it, the baby's head has to be crowned because you need to be able to place the ventouse on the top of the head. No one else can see what I'm doing on this except Isabel and Ashley, but I'm actually applying the ventouse to my own head because it's just sort of what we do when we explain these sorts of things. So you do need the head to be crowned to place the suction cup on the baby's head, and then it's a matter of pumping up the little suction cup, and the obstetrician will pull on the suction cup as the woman is pushing towards the obstetrician. If the baby's head isn't crowning and you can't see the baby's head, then that's not indicative of a ventouse being the right decision. You would actually have to go to a forceps. And the idea of a forceps delivery is that the forceps will go inside the woman, on the baby's, around the baby's cheeks, ideally, and pull that baby's head down. And sometimes that can work well enough to pull it down, so then you can actually then remove the forceps, and the woman can progress to pushing further and then pushing out the baby themselves. That's sort of a very brief, we might get further into it. There's lots of other reasons why you might do, rather than just focusing on the fetal position, actual reasons why you might consider an assisted delivery might be, it's very, very, very common in first-time mums who are labouring for the first time. As Michele Odont, a very famous obstetrician, says, the first labours are long and arduous. Most of us will agree with that. The second labours are very fast, very precipitate, and usually the mothers and babies are both in shock because it happens very quickly. And then the third labours are a bit unpredictable because they could go either way, and that's usually what we see clinically as well. So often because of those long, arduous deliveries with that first pregnancy, the women will get very tired. It might be an induction. If they have chosen a forceps delivery, an epidural during labour, that epidural will often limit the amount that the mum can move around. They will be sort of stuck on the bed to a certain degree. That can sometimes put the baby into a sort of less optimal position for delivery. But the women also can't feel the contractions as well, particularly in the second stage. So they don't really have that pushing sensation as strongly if they don't have the epidural. So sometimes that's why you need to lead onto a forceps delivery. There are some other sort of less common, but common enough scenarios where the mother gets to 10 centimetres, so fully dilated, but the baby's head is still quite high. And so they're not feeling that urge to push. And you give them, 2 hours if they need the full 2 hours to push, but that baby's head's still not crowning. Or if they've got an epidural, you'll give them an hour of passive descent and they'll just lie there and sleep and enjoy the epidural. And then 2 hours will begin after that hour of passive fetal head descent. And sometimes that head still might be quite high. So you'll actually need those forceps to bring that baby's head down further. Maybe sometimes maneuver that baby's head. So you've got to try and get a round head through a round hole, as opposed to if it's the baby's head slightly on an angle, it's trying to get a triangular shaped head, so to speak, through a round hole. So sometimes those forceps can just tweak that baby's head around a little bit. If that baby's head's low enough, sometimes an obstetrician's fingers, if the obstetrician has long fingers, can actually maneuver that baby's head with their own fingers, but sometimes you need the forceps. In cesarean sections, 9 times out of 10, all cesarean sections will have forceps at the same time. So they'll, particularly if the woman has labored, so they've labored, they've got to whatever dilatation they've got to, sometimes to fully, and the babies have progressed quite far down, so they'll actually have to pull the baby up to be able to deliver the baby via the cesarean section. So that's why a lot of C-section babies will have some marks on their cheeks. Go, that wasn't, how did that happen? That wasn't a forceps, but that's because they use forceps in C-section deliveries. Yeah.
That is so interesting, and I didn't know most of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite involved. Yeah.
Linda, if I can ask, when you were talking about ventus versus forceps, and you were kind of saying, indicating that with ventus, often the head has to be crowned because obviously you need to be able to put that cup, you know, the sucking cup on top of them. Versus with forceps, often the baby sits a little bit higher and the doctor kind of brings, if you want to guide the baby. In scenarios where the ventus are actually used first, that would mean that the baby is actually crowning. That you can see actually the head.
Yeah, ideally.
And then we go to the forceps at that point in time.
Yeah, exactly. You can have you can actually use a ventus and a forceps in the one delivery. Yep. So you might use the forceps to either pull that baby's head around a little bit, so it's a little bit more what we call direct OA, so it's going to glide out a little easier. And then give the mum a chance to push that baby down themselves. If they crown but they still can't quite push that baby out, then they can go on to a ventus as well. The other thing that can, does that clear that up?
That actually is pretty much what happened to me. The ventus first. However, I remember that the obstetrician tried twice and the ventus would just not stick. That to Ruby's, I remember him saying she's got a little bit too much hair, enough to her head, and straight away we went to forceps after that.
Yeah,
which well,
yeah, exactly. And often it's the other way as well. So it's all obstetrician choice as well. And you can move around the different instruments as they see fit. But often they'll try and go to the ventus first. And if that fails, then they'll go to a forceps delivery. And if that fails, then they'll say, this is not going to work. We need theatre for a cesarean section. And that's why often ventus deliveries can more easily be done in the birth room, but forceps deliveries have an added risk to them. And so they do often like to do those in the theatre because they'll often have to revert to a C-section. Yeah. So you want particularly the analgesia is also very different for a ventus versus a forceps delivery. So for a forceps delivery, often just filtration through the perineum with some local anaesthetic is enough. But for forceps delivery, you really do, if you haven't got an epidural on board, you want a spinal because it is quite, I will say painful. It's quite painful for the mum. Yeah.
I think this is a good spot actually to just jump to Isabel quickly to talk about your birthing experiences, because I think some of what Belinda has described matches your experience. So I'd love to hear what your birth with Ruby was like with that assisted delivery. And then if you want to also talk about your son's delivery as well and how that differed from Ruby's delivery.
Well, as I mentioned it earlier, my assisted birth was actually with Ruby, my first pregnancy. I was induced with her at 38 plus zero, so it was planned. The induction process went relatively well. I feel that it was pretty straightforward. I was administered Cervidil the night before, so I got to the hospital the night before the induction. I was given Cervidil to obviously open the cervix overnight, and that kind of worked pretty well. My cervix opened overnight to about only 1 centimeter, which was not huge amount, but sufficient for the obstetrician to be able to break my waters. That's how he explained it to me, which was done the next morning around the 8 o'clock mark. And from there, I was administered oxytocin to trigger my contractions. And I remember it probably took an hour and a half before I started to feel any contract. I could feel something going on, but it was not a real strong contractions. And I will be able to give the different, like to compare with Max, because the process was the same, but in fact, different in terms of what I feel, what I felt. But yeah, which really probably took a good hour and a half before I started to really feel some contractions. And it overall took a good 11 to 12 hours for me to reach 10 centimeters. So the progress was really long in terms of dilation of my cervix. I remember by 5 p.m. that day, so about 9 hours in, I actually requested the epidural because I was starting to get very tired. My blood sugar levels had been fantastic throughout the day, anywhere between 4 and 6. I was quite surprised, but everything was pretty much at bay in that regard. I had my epidural around the 5 o'clock mark, and for some bizarre reason, I don't know why, but with the epidural, my blood sugar went up. And this is something that's never been really explained to me. And even my diabetes educator at the time didn't really understand exactly what happened, but from the time I had my epidural, my blood sugar level raised around anywhere between 12 and 15 and maintained itself until Ruby was actually birth some 4.5 hours later. So I was getting tired, getting quite exhausted. In fact, I had been sick a few times as well, and then my blood sugar levels were a little bit more difficult to control. I actually started to push around the 7 p.m. mark when I was at 10, and I pushed for 2 hours. So Belinda was mentioning that two-hour mark before. This is exactly what happened for me. So my obstetrician had said to me he would let me give it a good try, but obviously he would not let me, you know, try for 24 hours. Pushed for 2 hours, and at that point I was very tired. Ruby, that was my understanding, that Ruby's head was in fact there, that it could be seen, but she was just not progressing any further in the birth canal. I was getting less strength, and at that point in time, the doctor just decided to use the ventouse to try to get her out. And as I mentioned before, two failed attempt, and he just mentioned that she had too much hair. So straight away, I remember still hear him calling for the forceps. He just called for the forceps. And at that point in time, my epidural, which I had 2 hours earlier before pushing and all that, had well kicked in. My epidural was not a full spinal, so I could move my legs. I was quite quite surprised with this, because my understanding back then of an epidural was just that we could not move and could not feel anything. In fact, I could move my legs without any problems. I could not feel them when I was touching them, but I could feel the pressure. So I could feel my contractions coming, which, to be honest, was great, because I felt I could really work with my obstetrician throughout the assisted birth. And this is really how it felt. He's actually called for the forceps. My understanding, obviously, I was not looking, but my understanding, he proceeded with the episiotomy first. And then I remember him inserting, I think, the forceps one after the other. So bearing in mind, I couldn't feel any pain, but I could feel the pressure. I could feel the movement inside. Probably not super comfortable, but no pain at all. Inserted the first forceps, then the second one. And I remember him asking me to tell him when my contractions were coming. And then he was, in fact, working with me every time I would push. And from that point in time, it probably took, and bearing in mind that, you know, I'm just trying to recollect the whole thing, but it was probably 5 to 10 minutes maximum from the moment he actually put the forceps in to the time Ruby was actually born. And a lot of people, when you talk about forceps deliveries, I feel they think that the doctor literally pulled the baby out of you. It didn't feel as such for me at all. It really felt like he was working with me. We were actually him working on this. And every time the contraction was coming, I could feel the pressure. I would tell him, and then I felt like he was actually working with his forceps. I only remember the last push, the one that actually got Ruby out. That's probably the only one where I felt that he was probably putting a little bit more strength to get out. The whole time, it really felt like he was just guiding her down the birth canal. So I feel like the experience that I've had when I've heard Belinda just before, it does matches pretty well.
And that's what forceps should be doing. It should just be what we call a lift out. If it's really, really painful, really, really difficult, really hard to manipulate, you've got to actually go, hang on a minute, are we actually doing the right intervention? Should we actually be doing a C-section? And it's not all about, you know, doing whatever we can to avoid a C-section. The more you have to push the barriers of any sort of instrumental, the more risk there is going to be to the mother and the baby as well, which we can talk about further into the episode. But, yeah, things like, and just going back to that, the way you describe your epidural, Isabel, that's exactly a perfect epidural. You don't want to feel, you don't want your legs to be really, really heavy. For an assisted delivery, you've got your legs up in the traditional lithotomy position, which you see in the movies. And you do need to be able to work with your obstetrician. That's the whole idea. If you can't because you have had an epidural that isn't quite working as optimally as we would like, the midwives are there to, you know, put their hand on your belly and feel when the contractions are building, so then they can communicate that to the woman so that they can also communicate that to the obstetrician to say, okay, the contraction's building up, time to push. And then when the contraction is building, the woman can start pushing, so then the obstetrician knows that they can pull either with the suction cup or the forceps delivery. But with the forceps in particular, if you don't have someone like Isabel who couldn't feel their contractions and can't communicate that to the obstetrician, you do need to rely on the midwife, and it's absolutely imperative for that midwife to communicate to the obstetrician when those contractions are building up and then when they're releasing, particularly when you are inserting those forceps in at the initial part of preparing for the delivery. Because if you've got you want to actually have no contraction or no uterine activity to actually insert those forceps. If you are in the middle of a contraction, you're going to put those forceps in and everything's clamped down on the baby, and the forceps are going to go in the wrong position. And that's where you will cause issues like excessive bruising around the baby's face. That's where you hear about Erb's palsy and facial droops and all that sort of a thing. So communication is absolutely essential in forceps delivery birth rooms or theatres, and then it really does need to be very, very quiet, so you're really only hearing the obstetrician and the woman speak and or the midwife. Yeah.
From my perspective, it felt that we were really working together, mm-hmm. and whilst people might think that the doctor does all the work, it didn't feel that at all for me.
Yeah.
Not empowering, in fact.
Yeah.
Really letting me guide him, in fact, with birth. So no, it was to a certain extent, I wouldn't say a pleasant experience, but I mean, there's some discomfort as well. I mean, you don't feel pain, but feel, you know, that there is some forceps in there, but it is not something that is traumatic at all.
Yeah,
you would say you were happy with that experience. I mean, you'd been pushing for over 2 hours at that point, and you said it only took 10 minutes from the insertion of forceps.
And that's a good point as well that you're making, Ashley, because I remember that at that point I was getting to the nearly, you know, 14-hour mark of labour. I was exhausted. I remember during that afternoon my contractions, with induction, the contractions are normally quite strong very quickly, and contractions were about a minute apart, and for a very long time I had nothing left in the tank pretty much. And as I indicated, from the 5 o'clock mark, my blood sugar levels had been rising. I don't know if it's a combination of the exhaustion, the stress as well. The, I don't know, the fact that maybe I hadn't drank that much throughout the day, different factors. But all that to say, at that point, I wanted Ruby, her side, safe and safe. And never did it cross my mind when the doctor called forceps for me to say, no, I don't want that. I was actually pretty happy that this is the way we went. I felt very comfortable and very confident. I knew that he was perfectly skilled to and trained to do the delivery, the assisted birth. And I was happy. I was happy that it was done within 5 minutes. Indeed.
Yeah, and as you said, like when your blood sugar is high, that also contributes to that feeling of tiredness and sluggishness, and probably contributed to that slowing down that you were experiencing as well, because that's just an effect of higher blood sugars. So and did they resolve pretty much after Ruby was delivered?
That's funny as well. I'm not even sure. I'm kind of looking forward to hear Belinda's thought on this. But that when I said before that when I my epidural blood sugar went up straight up to about anywhere between 12 and 15. And for majority of women, or probably all women, when you give birth and the placenta comes out, normally blood sugar levels drop. This has not been my case. And I still remember being in the hospital on day one, well, the next day, and speaking with my diabetes educator, because I was still on a 10 basal of about 115%. And that was never really explained. No one, and my diabetes educator at the time, could not really understand. They just put it down to maybe a reaction to the epidural. That's how it's been put to me. Not that it was a problem, but yep. I had my birth plan, and I had the diabetes management plan, and I had the post birth and what to do with the pump straight away, and I didn't need to go there because my blood glucose stayed above 10 for about 24 hours post. So I don't know if it was just my body's reaction to the whole thing. And as I said, it was not a traumatic birth at all, but somehow something happened in my body, and now my blood sugars maintain themselves around the 10 to 15 for a good 24 hours post-birth. I remember, though, during that 4 hours when I got my epidural, and then it was about 4 hours between the epidural and when Ruby came out, and I remember that mentally, because my blood sugars were around the 15 mark, it was constantly with me, because I was really worried that then Ruby would be born and probably have more chance of having blood sugar levels at birth, because during that 4 hours, her little pancreas was probably working hard to produce a little bit more insulin. Funnily enough is probably not the right term to use, but Ruby had some issues with her blood glucose level at birth. For a very short period of time, it was quickly resolved with a combination of frequent breastfeed, colostrum that I had expressed antenatally, and also she needed a glucose drip as well for the first 24 hours. So Ruby spent about that 24, maybe 36 hours in NICU, and then everything resolved itself, and she was back to normal, if I can put it this way, or blood glucose.
And that's just another reason why they might consider an assisted delivery for a mum with type 1 diabetes. So, there's the reasons for forceps will often be the fetal position. The mum just can't quite push the baby out because the baby's in an unusual position. It can be because the mum's got an epidural and they can't feel the urge to push. It can be just because the mum is tired and they just haven't got that stamina to keep going. But it can also be the vacuum delivery might not be appropriate, but they have seen a mum who's got blood sugars above target for X number of hours during labour. The longer that happens, that will increase the risk of the baby developing neonatal hyperglycemia. So I wasn't there at the birth, obviously, but from Isabel's perspective, she's saying, it was a long, arduous delivery, getting very tired, epidural on board. But if it would be interesting to speak to an obstetrician to see if they're, they probably agree with all of that, but they probably also go, actually, the main priority here is let's get the baby out, because these blood sugars are sitting where they are and the baby will struggle with that on the outside world. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other common reason for the deliveries is the baby's heart rate dropping as well, or rising. Sometimes it rises too far or it's dropping. It's like, we need to deliver the baby. But coming back to your individual experience of trying to understand why your blood sugars went up and stayed up, look, it's probably, it will be multifactorial. Hydration will be an issue. Hormones will be an issue because you're just at that maximum peak of labor, and those hormones are just like cascading through the roof. It could be, but not likely, but it certainly is something to consider, is when you have either a urine catheter, if you did have one that you may not have inserted, but also the epidural catheter, that's, you know, obviously puncturing the skin, so it will cause local and local inflammation. Any sort of inflammation for some people with pre-existing diabetes will cause a little spike in the blood sugars. For some, you'll see no difference, but for some it might. So it could be that. But I think that it's probably just Isabel and how your body deals with running a marathon, like literally running a marathon. So labor for a woman with type 1 diabetes is running a marathon, just like, and you prepare the same way and everyone's different. You're preparing for labor just like you're preparing for an athletic sport, like an AFL player who's on a pump and has type 1 diabetes. They've got very strict regimens for their type 1 diabetes management. Some of them will actually use pumps and MDI to manage their training versus their actual competitive sport days. They'll have very set regimens the day before their actual, say AFL match. And, you know, you'll see people who will spike with their blood sugars immediately after starting an elite sport. And then you'll see some that drop, and then they, some might spike initially and then they'll level out, and then it won't be until about 10 to 12 hours, which is the length of Isabel's labor, where they'll start to either rise or drop. So it could just be the way that your metabolic system, Isabel, deals with exercise, because that is what labor is. It is a marathon.
I would agree with that sentiment, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I might pop back to you because we touched on it a bit in some of what we were speaking about earlier and in Isabel's stories, but what would be some of the benefits and risks for the mum and bub in agreeing to using any form of assisted delivery?
Yep, sure. So, it's great that Isabel was happy to talk about the episiotomy. So episiotomies don't have to be done with forceps and or vacuum deliveries or ventouse deliveries. Some obstetricians will just routinely use an episiotomy if they know they're going to do a vacuum or forceps delivery. Some will look at it case by case, scenario by scenario. Some just feel more comfortable by doing an episiotomy. And then some will look at the woman's history. Have they had a delivery before? Have they had a tear before? Do they want to do an episiotomy to prevent that tear? Because you can actually have an episiotomy that unfortunately, very sadly, extends to a third degree tear as well. And that also comes down to skill of the operator as well, the obstetrician. Just to note that anyone doing an episiotomy, forceps or vacuum delivery, it will be no more junior than a registrar. So that's middle of the road doctor. You've got your junior residents, then you've got your registrar, then your consultant. In the private setting, obviously it's going to be consultant only, but in the public setting, it will be a registrar, but a registrar must have a consultant present in the room, or it'll be a consultant if they're on duty. If it's in theatre, then it'll usually be a surgeon plus a consultant or a surgeon plus a registrar. So you've got decent skill set there as well. But going back to the actual question, some of the risks, that was the question, wasn't it? The risks to the mum and bub, yeah. So,
and the benefits, obviously.
Yeah. So with the vacuum delivery, the benefits are that the benefits ideally, doesn't always work out this way, but ideally is exactly Isabel's story. It's meant to be empowering. It's not the obstetrician overtaking the delivery of the baby. The mum's still birthing the baby simply with just guidance. And it's just literally a lift out, whether it's forceps or vacuum. That doesn't always happen, and that might be because the wrong instrument's been chosen depending on where the baby actually is. So you really do need to do a really detailed vaginal examination to determine the choice of the instrument. And you want that obstetrician or that junior, that registrar, to be confident with that vaginal examination. So you want to get that right first. Some of the risks with the forceps delivery, there's not so much risk with the forceps delivery. 9 times out of 10, you'll have an episiotomy. So as I said, that may extend to a third degree tear as well. It is uncommon, but it does happen. It's uncomfortable, the forceps delivery, but there's no real risk to the woman per se, apart from just discomfort. It's more the recovery from the episiotomy thereafter. If you have a forceps delivery without an episiotomy, which doesn't happen so much, keeping in mind that the forceps are actually two large salad servers. When I say large, probably from my fingertips to my elbow, that's how long they are. And they literally look like metal salad servers. Sorry about the visuals. And so as Isabel said, you will wait for the contraction to not be present, put one in, and then if the contraction's building up, then wait till that contraction dies down and put the other one in when there's no uterine activity. That's incredibly important because otherwise you'll create a risk to the baby, which we'll get into in a minute. And then just deliver the baby. So as you can, if you can visualize that, there's not much other than discomfort risk to the mother. The risks to the baby in terms of using the forceps, you can have some bruising around the cheeks, although that usually is pretty superficial and takes maybe 24 hours to come down. If they have been applied at the wrong time and you have put them on during the uterine activity, that can sometimes cause facial droops and Erb's palsy type conditions. And very, very uncommonly, but it can sometimes cause fractures of the skull as well. But it is a risk. You do have to talk about it, but it doesn't. It doesn't happen very, very rarely. Thank goodness. In terms of that, there's not much more that will happen to the baby. The vacuum delivery, again, there's not much. You usually limit the number of tractions by the obstetrician to 3. Sometimes you do pull it and it pops off. You can reapply, especially if you're seeing progress, reapply it and put the traction on again. And you can do that a third time. If it pops off a third time, it's best to abort that and go to a forceps delivery. Obviously, it's not the right tool to be used. So there's not much. You can more commonly do a vacuum delivery without an episiotomy. It's a lot because that head's crowned. Because you're not doing as many episiotomies with vacuum deliveries, that you don't have that prolonged recovery for the mother. There's not much risk to a mother having a vacuum delivery. There is plenty of things to look out for. I won't say risk, but just things because they can be managed. Things to look out for a baby that's been born via vacuum delivery. Because you're placing it on the baby's head, if there's been excessive pushing, either really strong, intense pushing by the mother or prolonged pushing of, 2 hours or even more sometimes. And if that baby's being pushed in a suboptimal sort of position and that baby, could have been in another sort of position, which would have been made it easier in the first place. When a baby's being pushed by a mother without any sort of assisted birth, if the baby's in a funny position, they're sort of pushing against, literally like against a brick wall. So they're pushing against the pelvic wall, and that will just over time cause a bit of bruising and swelling on the head. And you might have seen or heard babies born with a bump on their head. And when you look at it, you go, oh, that's why the baby wasn't coming out, because it was in a funny position. So if you've got a baby's head that's starting to crown and you can see a little bit of swelling and then you pop a suction cup on top of it, you're putting a suction cup on top of swelling, which can do 2 things. It can cause a bit of a hematoma. So you might have heard that word, which is a little bit of a collection of blood just underneath their scalp, which sounds a little bit scary, but it's again, does self-resolve very, very quickly. There are some very rare scenarios where they'll need quite a lot of nursery sort of monitoring to make sure it doesn't become complicated. But even the very simple sort of hematomas on the babies that have been born via suction cup, that will 9 times out of 10 lead to jaundice. So babies born via a ventouse will very, very commonly end up needing phototherapy. And then that sort of runs into the cascade of intervention of, okay, the baby's going to go under phototherapy, and then the mum and the baby are separated, and then you have that delay in establishing breastfeeding, and you sort of, yeah, you're a bit torn. It's like you need that breast milk. You need the baby to jump on the breast to stimulate the milk in the first place, but the baby needs to be under the lights to stop those numbers from climbing in terms of the jaundice level. So it's a little bit of a vicious circle. So then you've got to get the mum onto the pump, but then you can't pull the baby out to get that breast milk. So often you do have to put a tube down to get that volume in, because you need that breast milk and or formula if the mum's not making enough milk, which can happen with type 1 diabetes. Sometimes it can delay that onset of breast milk. But you need that breast milk to flush that jaundice out. So it's a little bit of a... So you do often see those babies born in nursery for a prolonged time because you're just chasing your tail. Does that make sense?
Yep.
It does. From my experience, obviously, Ruby had a tiny little mark on her face with the foot. I would say just on the one side, and it probably started in the middle of her forehead and went above the eye and finished probably mid cheek. Was not a deep mark, or it was just red a little bit, not even swollen. And within exactly that 24 hours, by the next day, the mark had gone literally. And lucky enough, I mean, that's all pretty much we ended up with in terms of, if I can call it, a bit of a mark on the face, that's it.
The more I listen to Isabel's story, and I have heard it before as well, it just makes me call her assisted birth a textbook delivery. It went really well from my perspective as a professional, and that's good that it actually fits in with Isabel's perception of being, birth's not comfortable, but a relatively good experience.
It was, and that probably had me heading into my second birth with Max in such a positive way. I remember, you know, we actually followed exactly the same process, in fact, because it had worked, in a sense, well enough with Ruby. Induction had worked. I know that induction, more so for type 1 diabetes, does not necessarily work every single time, and we hear it all the time. It had worked well in my case, so my obstetrician just said, well, let's do exactly the same thing. So we did exactly the same thing, 37 plus 6 for Max on that Friday night, went to the hospital and got the cervidil again, and everything worked pretty much in the same order than the way it worked with Ruby, except that from the time I got my oxytocin in the morning, for Ruby, it probably took, as I said, an hour and a half before I started to feel something. And with Max, within 30 minutes, I was contracting hard. I could really feel it. And the whole labor with Max was 3 hours, 15 minutes all up. It was very, very quick. And Max did not need any assistance at all coming out. I remember, in fact, the first 2 hours, it took about that 2 hours to go from zero, well, considering that when the waters are broken, I was again around the 1 centimeter mark. So probably between 1 and 3 took about 2 hours, despite the strong contraction. And by then, I remember asking for the epidural, discussing it with the midwife. And she was saying to me, oh, I'm looking and you could potentially wait for another hour. But, you know, sometimes it goes really quickly with the second birth. And I remember with Ruby how exhausted I got. And at that point in time, I didn't know if it would be again a 10, 12 hour birth. The contractions were really, really, really strong. And I remember saying, and I was 3 centimeters. And I said, no, I think I would like to have it now. And by then, within 5 minutes, the specialist to actually do the epidural probably took 15 minutes all up. Don't know if I'm right with this, Belinda, but my recollection, about 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And the specialist walked out, I was ready to push. So I went from 3 centimeters when I said, yes, I would like to have it, him coming in, doing the procedure, and probably what happened, I think the body just remembered, first of all, but second of all as well, the position that I was sitting, the position I was in for the epidural, which is the legs down, rolled forward on the nurse actually shoulder, because Joe had gone for a walk. Longer labor. And I think that position rolled over probably helped Max coming down. And I went from 3 to 10 in literally 20 minutes. I remember the specialist walked out and the obstetrician walked back in and I said, Max is coming. I said, the baby's there. He's coming. And he looked down, he examined, and he said to me, oh, I think we've got another 5 or 10. He said, how about you don't push for 5 or 10? And he was walking towards the door. And I remember saying, I think this baby's coming now. And he turned around, came back. He said, okay, then let's push. And we did 3 or 4 push. Max was there.
Yeah. Did Joe make it back for the birth of Max?
Pardon me?
Did Joe make it back for the birth of Max, or was he still walking?
I think the specialist was walking out. The obstetrician walked in pretty much with Joe. And that's what baby's coming now. This baby's coming. This pretty much all happened, as I said, from the first 2 hours with the oxytocin, where the contractions were there, but I was just progressing between 1 and 3. That 20 minutes, that was it. And as I said, I probably pushed 3 times or 4 times with Max. I remember, if I can compare the forcep delivery with Ruby versus, you know, totally assisted free, if I can put it this way, or assisted free.
Vaginal birth.
Yeah, with Max, the difference. I actually, people will say that I'm a bit silly, but I think I really enjoyed the birth with Max. It was obviously painful, but I had the epidural that had kicked in, and kicked in just the last minute, because bearing in mind that I just got it in. I actually felt pretty much all the pressure. I really felt Max coming down the birth canal from A to Z. I can actually still remember it. And that's what I did not feel 100% with Ruby, probably because there was the forceps in there as well, trying to move her around a little bit and guide her in her descent. As with Max, it was actually a beautiful feeling.
Yeah. And you also had the epidural during labor for Ruby?
Yep.
Whereas the epidural was probably actually being inserted as you were at the pushing stage. When you measure dilatation in a second time mum, third time mum, fourth time mum, the centimetres doesn't really equal what it does when you're a first time mum. So that 1 centimetre to 5 centimetre for a first time mum is early latent phase of labour. 6 centimetres to 10 centimetres is very active labour. And it literally is 1 centimetre per hour, and it takes as long as it takes. But for a first-time mum who might be 5 centimetres, which you probably were when you were having the epidural inserted, 5 centimetres for a second-time mum is really actually equal to 9 centimetres. Yep. Because that cervix has been stretched before quite nicely by the first baby. And that's why you will go from 3 centimetres to 10 centimetres very, very fast. That cervix will just open up and that baby's head will just come literally pelting down to the pelvic floor. And that's what you felt. Yeah. And that's why also the baby birthing is a lot easier in terms of not needing an assisted delivery. But also barely needing any pushes, maybe 3 pushes, 5 pushes, because that cervix is just so stretchy from that first baby. Yeah.
That you've used the wording, the feeling the urge to push just before. And I really feel that at any point in time with Ruby, the whole way through, as with Matt, I was telling the obstetrician that this baby's coming, he's coming now. I remember that urge to push. I could feel him. And in terms of outcome, I mean, we did the whole same process, obviously, but Max did not need any forceps. There was no ventus. There was obviously no tear either, no episiotomy needed. It was just 100% vaginal birth, unassisted vaginal birth, if I can put it this way.
And that probably actually leads into something quite nicely that you can try and do to minimize the need for any sort of assisted birth, whether it's your first baby or third baby or fifth baby. Because you felt that baby come down and you got that urge to push and it crowned yourself, which you didn't really get with Ruby, because the forceps were doing all that for you, that baby was crowning and was stretching that perineum, and you probably felt a lot of burning and stinging. And that's a very much needed process that you often won't feel with the forceps delivery. And then that reduces the risk of tearing, because when you feel all of that and you feel that urge to push, because that baby's head is right there and that baby's head has made contact with the mum's down below parts, being the perineum, That will actually perfuse and bring all that blood to the perineum, which will actually thin it out and stop that perineum ideally from tearing. Whereas if you don't get that process because the baby's sitting a little bit high and the instrument, like the forceps or the vacuum, is in the way, that's where you can actually turn to warm compresses or warm pads. The midwife can pop that on the perineum as they're preparing for the assisted delivery to try and dilate all that blood through the perineum to try and minimize the tearing from happening. Yeah.
It's very interesting to listen to, what you've described, Belinda, and then your story, Isabel, because it sounds very, what you both described is very similar. Even down to the fact, when Belinda said earlier that your first birth is long and therefore, the likelihood of assisted births is probably increased, and then your second labour is a lot shorter, and it's very much matched up with what Isabel's described as well.
Isabel's probably a perfect, sorry to jump in, he's probably the perfect example just to reassure women who do have that fear of, I had an assisted delivery with their first baby. Yeah. Am I going to have it again? And, they don't really want that. And a lot of women will actually be quite traumatized by an episiotomy alone. They might have had a forceps delivery and episiotomy, or they might have just had an episiotomy. And it's actually the episiotomy part that they're most traumatized by. To hear Isabel's story, which is quite common if it goes well, which I really do think it did for Isabel, from a professional perspective as well, to see that, that is common, what happened with Ruby's delivery, and then pretty much intervention-free with Max's delivery. So that's probably the biggest take-home reassuring message for women out there listening to this. What's happened the first time won't necessarily and most commonly won't happen the second time.
And even in terms of the episiotomy, which I had with Ruby, obviously, I have to admit the recovery part, I mean, at that point in time, it's hard for me to say. At that point in time, I could not compare with anything else, but I did not feel that it took that long for me to heal. And it did heal very, very well. In fact, I never had any problem after it probably took maybe a few weeks before I could feel that everything was pretty much back to normal. I remember probably having some urinary incontinence or minor urinary incontinence for probably 3 to 4 months. I remember pushing the pram, going for long walks, and then if I was sneezing, I was struggling a little bit. And I've always had that impression that potentially the forceps could have contributed to this. Mind you, I've never researched it or never queried with my obstetrician down the track after when I had my checkup with him. I always thought, well, that's probably related. Mind you, we hear all the time that women at birth can have actually problem in that regard. But apart from this, I haven't had any other issues at all. Yeah. Episiotomy was not a traumatic thing at all for me. And I went back to normal very quickly post-birth as well.
Yeah.
Actually, Belinda, that brings me to a question. Yeah. With the episiotomy, what Isabel's just described with that urinary incontinence, I know that that can be a factor with tears. That was a factor with my tear. Yeah. Is that a normal factor with episiotomies? Do they have to go through the OASIS clinic or, whatever kind of follow-up clinic like you would with a tear, or is it something separate?
Usually not. If it's just an episiotomy itself, look, with episiotomies, it can certainly cause prolonged incontinence issues. It's a little bit of a trick with episiotomies and only episiotomies. If a woman has had episiotomy that's extended through to a tear, then yes, that will be referred on to incontinence and physio. You'll receive a incontinence and physio referral for a few weeks post-birth. If it's just an episiotomy alone, you don't usually need ongoing care because it is expected that you will experience some incontinence, not immediately, but afterwards. The challenge is that if you have a first degree or a second degree tear, you can get stuck onto your pelvic floor exercises straight away, which is really, really recommended. Like, as soon as you've gone to the postnatal ward, start doing them when you're breastfeeding. Not that you've got your head around pelvic floor exercises because I mean, really, you're focusing on trying to breastfeed your baby. But that's the take-home message. If you've got a third degree or a fourth degree tear and an episiotomy as well, or just an episiotomy, it is best to wait for around 2 weeks before you get onto those pelvic floor exercises. And that's the catch. It's actually those women who have had a third degree, fourth degree, and or an episiotomy, you want them to get stuck onto the pelvic floor exercises to try and reduce the impact of that incontinence, but you don't want them to get stuck onto the pelvic floor exercises too fast, because you need to allow that healing, gentle healing, to happen.
Yep.
So it's a little bit of a catch. All you can do is just, you know, wait out the fortnight and then really get stuck onto those pelvic floor exercises, like, religiously. And probably one of the best things to do is actually download the Continence Australia app to your phone. And everyone can do that right now, whether they've had their babies 10 years ago, 2 years ago, haven't had a baby. We should all be doing it right here, right now, as we're zooming around the world. You just press a button and it will actually teach you how to breathe in, breathe out, and do the exercises.
Yeah,
so it's a very visual guide. Yeah, so really important part. But in terms of the forceps and the vacuum delivery, there's some perhaps myths that it may contribute to incontinence, but there's not a lot of hard data, yeah, to say that it will cause incontinence. It's the same as talking about modes of delivery and encouraging the mum to be in a special position as they're actually pushing that baby out, whether they're on all fours, on their side, on a birth stool. There's a lot of myths out there in the midwifery way of supporting a woman that, you know, you do this, you don't do that, and it won't cause a tear. But again, there's not a lot of hard data to back that up.
Yeah. I've got two questions left. Hopefully they're pretty quick, but we'll see. Belle, for you, how common are assisted births? That one may be a little bit tricky to answer because it will probably depend on each woman, but
yeah, look, it does. It's very, I don't want to give stats out because it really is a very individual scenario, and it should be individual, and it should also be individual dependent on the woman's situation, but also the hospital, the skill, the available facilities, the comfort of the obstetrician. But what I will say is, as I've alluded to earlier, what Isabel has achieved with both her births, that is very common. That is how we often see it. And that is actually how we like to see it as well. You know, as I said, long, arduous first pregnancies, very common to lead to some sort of assisted birth or an induction, whether it's your first or your second, fourth, fifth, sixth baby. You as soon as you have an induction, you do often lead into that cascade of intervention, because you, even if it's your fourth baby, but you need an induction because you've got type 1 diabetes, because that's just what they do. We won't talk about that on this podcast because that'll go on for another 10 hours, but you need that, you know, you need that syntocin, and the syntocin does bring on your contractions very hard and fast. It can be quite unpleasant, that syntocin, for many women. And so then you'll turn to that epidural to try and get yourself through the pain associated to the syntocin infusion. It's then the epidural that will often prevent the mum from moving around as well or as much. And then it's that then will lead to the baby being in a funny position, which will then lead on to some sort of assisted delivery. So yeah, for inductions, regardless of how many babies the mum has had, an assisted delivery is very common. For first-time mums, whether it's a spontaneous labour with no induction required, or a first-time mum who has had two induction, very, very common. For a second-time mum, whether it's an induction or a spontaneous labour, it's not that common, because particularly if the mum has had a vaginal birth before, because the body's gone through the motion, the labours are often very fast and everything's been stretched.
Yep. Thank
you. Does that answer?
Yeah. It does. It does. Yeah. It kind of like helps to give that idea that it's, you know, not something that's really rare and due to complications or anything. So.
And the only other thing to say would be if a mum has had, and I've actually got, I've heard a few of these recently, the mum has had a elective cesarean for their first baby for whatever reason, and then they've managed to attempt a VBAC. And the VBAC has resulted in, it is still a vaginal birth, but they did need a forceps delivery or a vacuum delivery. And that's just simply because, opposite to what Isabel did with Max, that nothing's been stretched. So is their second baby, but because it's their first labour, it's essentially their first time. So therefore they're at a higher risk of an instrumental.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
The next question is going to be for the both of you. And then I've got a little extra question for Isabel. So for both of you, is there anything that you would tell a woman, anything extra that you would tell a woman who may have an assisted delivery?
Well, from my perspective, the first thing is that I don't think we can necessarily tell in advance, right? Someone that will have an assisted birth delivery, obviously, we just never know what we're heading for. You just never know in advance if your delivery will result in assisted delivery. However, I think what I would like women to think about is in preparing for baby delivery. When you're at home in the weeks prior and you're preparing your birthing plan and you're thinking about how you would like it to happen, or you always have a little bit of your plan A and your plan B in your head, I think it would be important for women to also think that it might be a possibility. And in doing so, from my experience anyway, I would like women to remember that, as Belinda and just mentioned before, assisted deliveries are not uncommon, obviously. In some circumstances, in fact, when you have all the factors in, they are routinely performed and practiced. I would not want women to be fearful of having an assisted delivery. I think the benefits of, we've discussed that before, the benefits of having an assisted delivery are mostly centered around, obviously, protecting both the mother's health and the baby's health, first of all, first and foremost, which is super important. And it's also, it's there to probably avoid a potential C-section, which is major surgery. We don't want to have the baby stuck there and the mum not being able to push anymore. And so I think it's all centered around this. And it's also centered around reducing the amount of time that you spend in active labor in the end. So from my perspective, I think it'd be really important for women to bear in mind that if this is the end point, in a sense, that you do need forceps or ventus, bear in mind that the benefits, I think, are outweighs the risk that could be associated of not going down that path, in fact.
Yeah. And that actually triggers a really important thing that we all need to talk about. Often because we can't plan, there's, as I said, Michaela Dont, who's a French obstetrician, says you can't diagnose a vaginal birth until it's happened. You can't diagnose a vaginal birth until that baby is on the mother's chest. Because you just don't know if it's going to happen or not. No one, no matter how good that obstetrician or that midwife is, it will be what it will be. And when you're coming to the assisted delivery kind of side of things, where you're talking about, you know, do we do an episiotomy? Do we need to do it fast? Is it now quickly time to implement forceps or vacuum? Midwives aren't big fans of having to do help with assisted deliveries, only because, like, they will do what we have to do to, as Isabel said, have a healthy mum and healthy baby. But the time frame that we decide on doing a assisted delivery is very, very short, and they're running all over the place to prepare all the different equipment, the sterile field, the local anaesthetic. They're calling the paediatric team, who have to be present at an assisted birth, just in case. Not often will they have to do anything, but they'll be present just in case. They might just even be outside the room. They'll have to do cord gases. That's routine in Australia now, from the cord of the baby, just to validate that, you know, that was the right decision. And so a lot is happening in that birth room, and a lot of extra people come into the room as well. And that can be quite confronting for the partner, more so than the women. And so you're trying to educate the partner as well as, you know, what's about to happen, and it's all going to become very overwhelming, as well as prepare everything at the same time. But most importantly, you're also trying to communicate what's happening to a mother who's at their most vulnerable state of labor. Their hormones are just at the absolute peak. They're having 2-minute contractions at minimum, and often 1-minute contractions. So your time frame of being able to communicate to them about what's going to happen, and trying to gain their consent is very, very challenging. So informed consent at this point of the labour is arguably not necessarily done properly. But then how do you do it when you've got that scenario where the woman's breathing and can't focus on what you're actually saying? So that's the best thing about these sorts of podcast platforms, thanks to you, Ashley and Rachel and Carly, talking about it now. And that's what Isabel introduced that very nicely. So a great segue. Often women will feel like they didn't get a choice in that episiotomy being done, but it's very hard for the obstetricians to sort of create that choice, because they've got that environment of, it's like, well, it's really hard to go through all the risks of an episiotomy and gain written consent when you're trying to push a baby out. So I don't have the answers, but as Isabel alluded to, we just have to have those conversations antenatally. And we all know that that doesn't happen very well, because the model of care for women with type 1 diabetes, you don't see the midwives very, you know, if ever, or very, very rarely. And the appointments are very short and sweet. And they're very focused on the diabetes as well. So you don't get that chance to talk about these things.
Yeah, talk with me. So I don't have that fear.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's these sorts of platforms, these podcasts, you know, you just need to share, so that women are prepared for what may happen. Doesn't mean it will happen, but, you know, I think, yeah, women do need to understand that sometimes the period of giving consent, whether it's a consent to an episiotomy, consent to a forceps, consent to a ventouse, most times, which I think came through Isabel's story, you often will just go with the obstetrician because you trust them. And at the end of the day, you just want to be, you want your baby earthside. But there are some scenarios where women struggle with that, and they do develop a little bit of PTSD or PND, postnatal depression, because they feel like they were disempowered, and that consent was, opportunity was robbed from them. So it's again, just comes down to sharing as much information antenatally so that you can be prepared for all scenarios. Yeah.
My experience, what happened is that I actually raised internally with my obstetrician the question about episiotomy and in which circumstances he was normally practicing them. And we had that discussion for maybe a 10 minutes in his office. And it's nearly, if I couldn't say that I kind of consented in advance, but I kind of gave him the okay. I trusted him to be a decision at the time it would be right for an episiotomy to occur. And I think he understood that from that conversation as well that we had, because as I explained before, all I remembered was him calling the forceps, and I felt like it all happened. It's not like if you say, oh, Isabel, remember what we spoke about 2 weeks ago or a week ago? Now I'm going to proceed with it. It didn't go this way, but I had that conversation with him. So I felt 100% I was confident. I was trusting him. And that's probably why it was not a bit of a surprise to me. Yeah. We did it without any issue.
And I think that just highlights, and it's probably a really good note to sort of conclude on, seek information. Don't just go into antenatal appointments, especially as you get close in third trimester to having the baby. Don't just go with the status quo. Question them. And it's okay to question them. It's your experience. It's your, okay, it might be your first baby. They're an obstetrician of 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, but you've got to ask questions. It's like learning in a school or a university. If you don't ask questions, you don't know. The more you ask questions, the more you'll be prepared, and the more empowered you'll be. Yeah. And that builds trust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's such an important point that you've both made about having those conversations and being aware of the information about what could happen and what you might need to help deliver your baby safely for you and your baby. So have that conversation with your obstetrician, with your midwife. If you haven't had that conversation, ask to have that conversation. The last thing I'm going to do is I'm actually going to ask Isabel to share a little bit about her Park Hyatt stay. Because I've wanted to ask somebody about that experience of being in a hotel after the birth of their baby. And when Isabel said she'd had that experience, I said, I know it's not related, but please share it.
Over to you, Isabel.
All right. So I was talking about the Park Hyatt experience, and I was in the that so the hospital where I birth, which is a private hospital, obviously runs a maternity program in association with the Park Hyatt that is located in Melbourne, on the edge of Melbourne CBD. And that program is, in fact, it's really important for people to understand that it's whereby the medical circumstances of the mother and the ones of the baby allow, then the mother is given the option of being to a five-star, well, the five-star Park Hyatt Hotel in Melbourne, which is a very short distance from the hospital itself. And obviously, I want people to bear in mind that with that program, which can sound a little bit bizarre when you just birth your baby and then you're transferred to an hotel, but the care of the mother and the baby are paramount. The hospital has very strict selections criteria for family who are eligible to leave the hospital to be then transferred to Park Hyatt. So that's really important to bear in mind. The concept as such, if I can put it this way, so what's the idea behind the maternity program and why they're doing it? I think it is a very clever program. It enables mothers to bond with their new baby, soaking early days pretty much with baby in a quite elegant environment rather than an hospital, whilst having all the support that the mother needs and the baby needs from the midwives as well during that very important time. So how it works is that at the Park Hyatt in Melbourne, a full floor is, and I could not tell you exactly how many rooms, but it might be 10 or 12 or 15 rooms. Very luxurious room. I have to admit, I traveled the world in my life, and that's the most luxurious room stayed at with Italian marble
bathroom. You deserve it. You just had a baby.
Italian marble bathroom. It was absolutely, I walked in and I couldn't believe it. It is actually gigantic. There are, I think, two rooms that are allocated to the midwives actually on the floor. So they're midwives 24/7. Obviously, partners and siblings are also welcome to stay, which is fabulous. So you can just be yourself with your baby. The partner can stay. If you have younger siblings as well and you're not too tired, the room is big enough that it can accommodate all these people. And the idea,
bed is big enough.
Pardon me?
The bed is big enough to accommodate.
Big size. And the idea is obviously that you want to have mum and bub and dad and potentially, you know, a two-year-old little baby brother or baby sister who becomes a big brother or big sister to actually soak in all these first hours, these first days. If there's a room available and you're actually well enough to be transferred straight away the next day, you can spend you know, your 4 or 5 days, well, your 4 days there. So, and it enables, I think, the family to spend quality time together and enables them to bond with the new addition to the family. As I indicated, I don't think I need to say it again, these rooms are super luxurious and they're adapted for newborns. So as you walked in, I had a crib, I had a changing table, I had also a baby bath as well for the bathroom. So everything is actually adapted for you and baby to just walk in. You have a magnificent view through the window. You can see the edge of Melbourne CBD, the skyline. It's just across the road of Treasury and Fitzroy Garden and the St. Patrick's Cathedral. It's fabulous. You can also, one thing that they tell you about, you can use the hotel facility. I always found a bit funny because when you've just given birth, you certainly don't want to go and use the gym. So, you know, these are not what you go for. You order your meals as well. It's all room serviced. The beauty of this is that it's room serviced, so it's at a time that best suits you and your baby's requirement feeding time. You will probably all remember when you're in hospital, midwives comes in and out constantly, and then they need to do something straight away, and that's totally understanding because, you know, there's multiple patients there that they've got to see in the day. But over there, because there's only two midwives at a time on the floor, they come to see you once a day. Obviously, they're there if you need them. You can call them. You can walk to them. But they come, there's less disturbance. So you really have that quality time to bond with baby. You order your meals whenever you're ready. It's getting rolled to your door. It's a fabulous program. I've had the chance, as I said, a room freed up for me in the last 36 hours. I had only one night at Park Hyatt. But it is a fantastic program. I know that program that has been around for a little while, not just with the hospital I birth at, but I know someone who's had was I had a child 12 years ago, and was also transferred to an hotel at that time. So I think it's been running around probably more in the private sector.
Yeah.
For some time, and everything is looked at. You're also still under the care of the obstetrician. So during the time that you stay at the Park Hyatt, they organise a transfer for you. So an escort vehicle comes and gets you, and it's adapted. There's a baby capsule as well in the vehicle. Everything is thought about. So there's absolutely, it's totally stress free, and the partner can come and stay, and the kids as well.
I think the
I think what you said about the food coming in a time that suits you.
Yeah.
When you have diabetes,
yep.
That would be so helpful, because, you know, you don't have to conform to the hospital set times of food delivery, which may not work for you, especially when you do have doctors and midwives and whoever else coming in and out, and then you might miss a food delivery.
Right, and I remember,
so it ensures that you actually get fed.
And you actually, I mean, you're in a 5-star hotel, right? So the meals, I don't need to just... Obviously, it's room service. It gets rolled to your door. And the main meal was always, it was coming in a little table with the side panel that would actually lift up. And under it, there was actually a little cavity there with a door. And they would put my main meal in there, and it was keeping it warm. So if for some reason I'm calling for my meal and the meal is arriving in 20 minutes, and then Bob wakes up and needs another feed or something, I could just leave it there and I could still eat warm. In 30 minutes or 45 minutes time, which is
what we found in hospital was that they would take your meal away if you hadn't had the chance to finish it because of that. So that's so good.
The whole concept of the program is that it declinicalizes everything, and it takes you from a woman-centered approach to care in the hospital to a family-centered model of care.
Whilst you do have the midwives there to help you, to help with the patient, to help every question you've got, it's just every 2 hours or as per schedule, you can call them and then they turn up. They're literally just the door, you know, next to yours. So the stress is not there. So you know that you do have someone there to help you out if need be. Yeah. But fabulous program, to be honest.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I learned so much tonight.
Thanks for having us. It was great.
It was a super interesting conversation, ladies. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another week of Mama Bees. We would like to extend a special thanks to Belinda for sharing her expertise, and to Isabel, Joe, Ruby and Max for sharing a story that is special to them with us today. Make sure you subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcast so you never miss an episode, and leave us a review so that others can find us too. Remember to follow us on Facebook, just search Mama Bees, Twitter at Mama Beaties, or on Instagram at MamaBeaties_podcast. To reach out, please email us at mamabeaties.podcast@gmail.com. If during this podcast series you feel you need to reach out for additional support, please contact your usual training team, PENDA's National Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Helpline on 1300 726 306 or Lifeline on 13 11 14 outside of PENDA's operating hours.